We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is Tyrese Haliburton, and you're listening to Setting the Pace.
Indiana, home of Pacers basketball.
Miller for three, and he got it.
Legends have been born.
Miller retreats to the three-point line.
Memories have been made.
Haliburton, a deep three for the lead.
Bam, baby!
Great basketball has been played.
Nembhard away. Hits a three at the buzzer to win the game.
In 49 states, it's just basketball.
Flips it to the big fella, fake shoots, and hits!
But this is Indiana.
Flips it down.
And you're listening to Setting the Pace.
Let's go!
Your go-to Pacers podcast.
Setting the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci. Alex and Allison.
Setting the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Allison.
Setting the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Allison.
Setting the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Allison.
We got Pacers hooping. Let's talk stats. Hot takes. All facts. New topics. Updates. Three-pointers. Fast breaks. We keep scoring. We don't need to stop. New episodes. Weekly drops. This your number one podcast. Sweeping every team. We gon' need a mop.
Setting like the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Allison.
Setting the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Allison.
Setting the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Allison.
Setting the pace with Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Fauci.
Alex and Allison.
Happy Wednesday, everybody. Welcome back to another episode here of your go-to Pacers podcast, Setting the Pace. I'm your host, Alex Gold. No Fauci once again today, but have no fear, ladies and gentlemen. We have Caitlin Cooper here to fill Fauci's shoes and talk Pacers basketball on the pond today. So, Caitlin, thanks so much for joining. How are you?
Big shoes to fill. Also, I have to, like, boost up my energy, I feel, for the start of this. Like, all of us have lost, like, a night of sleep, at least, from the West Coast road trip, so...
I'm so glad they're done. Like, when I saw that was the last game, I said, oh, thank God. Like, it just back-to-backs on the West Coast are just brutal. Like, not even a day in between to get your sleep. Like, I was doing okay. I took a nap on Sunday afternoon, but it's really hard to take a nap on Monday when you're at work all day and then have to come home, prepare for things. I even was a guest on a podcast. I don't know why I said yes, but I did on a podcast Monday night at 8:30. I think it was to try to keep myself awake before the game tipped off. But, I mean, I'm sitting there like I'm doing everything I can. I'm making an extra cup of coffee, like just trying to stay awake for this game. But thankfully they got the win, so I was a little bit more energized. Seeing them go through what they went through against the Lakers with all the foul calls, I think that would have put me to sleep a lot quicker on Monday. But what did you think of those two games over the weekend? I mean, obviously playing both LA teams, pretty impressive from the Pacers to bounce back against the Clippers. But that game against LA, that was crazy. 150 points, that's a lot of points.
That is a lot of points for sure. Just when I thought that hot girl basketball had run its course, it comes roaring back. I didn't think I had just said on my prior mailbag that I did with Samson Folk, we had a debate over that about whether there would be any more games where the Pacers were playing where they would have to win in like a 150 point environment. And I said, I don't know if that's fully back. It seems like they've tilted it a little bit more towards defense. And there we are with the Laker game. Obviously, a lot of that had to do with some of the fouling as far as the Laker score outcome of it has to go. But I think overall, my big takeaway from those two games is probably what everybody's big takeaway was, that it was really an emergence of Pascal Siakam, and not so much because of something different that Pascal did, but more that he was more visible from his teammates and was getting a lot more field goal attempts and touches in his optimum spots on the floor than what we had seen in some other recent games. If people think back to, you know, the loss here most recently to the depleted Cavs team, and he's in the fourth quarter, he had one shot in the fourth quarter. And a couple times he had favorable switches, favorable mismatches out of actions that the Pacers run. These aren't necessarily like, this word is going to be too harsh, but it's not like he's hijacking a play in order to get that mismatch. It's coming organically through the sets, and he wasn't necessarily getting touches within that offense where I felt like maybe they could have leaned a little bit more that way. Similarly to the end of the game against the Bulls, where I think he had one field goal attempt with about 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, another field goal attempt in the overtime, and that was kind of it for him. Whereas in this game, it was very clear that he was going to have advantages. He was, we can get into a little bit more with the Clipper game, kind of a missing chess piece that they didn't have by comparison to the game that they played against the Clippers in December. So, borrowed a phrase, I know you used it for your podcast title, the Raptors Twitter had popularized Pascalifornia for his very long-standing track record of playing very well in the state of California, and that certainly continued for the Pacers. So he was my big takeaway from those two games for sure.
I'm glad you brought that up. I did give you a shout out at the end of the podcast for that title, and then I saw that it was from the Raptors Twitter too, so I was glad you gave them the shout out, because as soon as I'm like wrapping up my interview with JMV for the post-game recap, here it is on Pacers Twitter. I get a notification. It's Caitlin's tweet right there in the middle of stuff. And it says Pascalifornia. And I said, well, I feel like I really can't use this just for the title itself. So I said jaywalking through Pascalifornia to tie in Jairus Walker into the conversation for that game. So it did kind of help me out there a little bit to use a more two play on words there. But I love that analogy. It's such a great way to play those words on with each other, because Pascal was so good this weekend, like you said. And that was one thing we've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast. Like, is he going to get more touches when he's shooting the ball efficient? Like 8 of 12 against Chicago. Like, why did he only get 12 touches? And it was so strange. And I was at that Cavaliers game, and I know Obi Toppin had a good plus minus in that game, when I know Obi did some good things in that game, but I felt like Rick went with him a little bit too long and then kind of brought Pascal back too late in the end of the fourth quarter with like 3 minutes left. But he had even hesitated to put him in there at that point because they had called a timeout. They put the same five back on, but then when the Cavaliers made a substitution, that's when he put Pascal back into the game. And I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. So I think they're just starting to find that right balance of how many shots he should be getting and trying to get it within the flow of the offense. Because like you said, you don't want it to be where he's just taking over the game. But I think that him being more assertive out there on the floor is only going to open up opportunities for other guys, and we kind of saw that with Miles Turner there in the third quarter against the Clippers. Like, what a start for him to get the quarter going with the offensive barrage that he had. So I just think that there's a lot of different ways they can make this work.
I think that's why the Clippers game stands out so much too, is because the Clippers tried a lot of different things and the Pacers had a different player who was able to provide an answer for all of those things. So very early they're playing Zubats and drop coverage against Tyrese Halliburton. Tyrese starts 5 of 6 from three, very hot. By halftime, they're going to have to make a change there. You're not going to continue to play that same way with the way that Tyrese had started. So the very first possession out of halftime, they blitz Tyrese. Miles pops out to three, and as you're mentioning, now Miles becomes a very clear answer against that change in coverage. Eventually, they take Zubats off the floor, I think 4 minutes into the third quarter, and they end up going and playing very small. And then that's by the end of that quarter is when Pascal and the all bench unit really took over. And he was very reminiscent of what we as Pacer fans have watched other teams do to the Pacers earlier in this season, because the Clippers decide that they're going to pivot to small ball with either Kawhi or PJ Tucker being the tallest player on the floor, kind of playing nominal five. And Pascal's just shooting over the top of whatever switch he gets. So if he gets a switch over Russell Westbrook, if he has PJ Tucker in space, if, you know, even if it was Coffee a few times, like he gave buckets to pretty much everybody. And I feel like that's what we were watching so often with the Pacers smaller, you know, playing 8 guards a night, is that they didn't really have answers and the Clippers really didn't have an answer for Pascal. So just to see the Pacers be able to go through that evolution, especially by comparison to when they gave up 150 points to the Clippers in December, and it was the exact reverse of that. Ty Lue started out very aggressive against Tyrese and had Zubats in a blitz from the start. Miles and Jalen Smith aren't available. Isaiah Jackson did get loose as a short roller by halftime. They're like, we need to make an adjustment again. And the adjustment at that point was, let's put Zubats on Bruce Brown. Let's put Zubats on TJ McConnell. And the Clippers really, really won those minutes, like +8 over the 8 minutes that Zubats played this time around. Zubats literally only played 8 minutes in the second half, the entirety of it. Mm-hmm. So just seeing the difference, like I said, Pascal was very much a chess piece for the Pacers over this weekend, and specifically in that game that they just did not have access to prior to trading for him.
Maybe I'm just tired from the last two games, but thinking about the Pacers playing the Clippers, you know, with Bruce Brown still on the team, feels like three seasons ago. I know it sounds crazy, but like,
no, it definitely does.
As you were talking about that, I said, oh yeah, that does ring a bell with how they did switch Zubac onto Brown and McConnell and things like that. And I forgot both Jalen and Miles were out, and Ajax had a good game there. He got going there, I think, early in the first half, like you said. So, you know, I felt like in this game against the Clippers on Monday, one thing we really saw the Pacers do was attack Zubac in that drop coverage, and it was just like barbecue chicken left and right. And then I felt like all the P.J. Tucker moments or all the P.J. Tucker minutes were a positive for the Pacers as well. Yes. I was like, man, can they just keep P.J. Tucker and Zubac out there all at one time? Because that's when I felt like the Clippers had a big weakness to attack. And when those two guys weren't on the floor, it felt like they were a better team. So I don't know. I think the Clippers are a weird team. They're not playing good basketball right now. They've been pretty mediocre since the All-Star break. I think they've only beaten one team that has an above 500 record since that point. So it's like the Pacers really needed this win as they're trying to get themselves, you know, we've talked about it before, like playoff standing. It's like so close right now for all these teams, really. It's crazy, like three through eight. So I don't know what's going to happen, but I know with nine games left, like the Pacers, every game is super important. And for me, and I'm sure you probably feel this way too, like I'm glad to see them winning a lot more on the road now. Six of their last seven on the road. They're probably going to be a road playoff team based on where they're going to get a spot in the standings. So to me, that's great experience for them to kind of get that now heading into the playoffs, knowing they can win on the road.
Especially because they were able to erase some of that deficit against the Lakers and make it very close, despite the fact that they had ended up losing that game in the end anyways. And then the Clippers made a little bit of a spirited run toward the end, and the Pacers were able to maintain distance there. Obviously, go into the Golden State game, and we didn't really mention that with talking more about Battle LA, but the Warriors, if they had gone to the 1-2-2 zone earlier than what they did, I really wonder what would have happened in that game, because the numbers for the Pacers against that zone were quite poor. I don't have that in front of me, but I think it was like they scored points on 2 of 12 zone possessions in the fourth quarter against the Warriors. They were having some trouble getting into some of their zone busters. I didn't really understand which players were flashing into the middle against it rather than just kind of leaning into, like what we've been saying, Pascal a little bit more as a playmaker going into the middle. They did get to that once late, but they were able to outlast that and maintain again to be able to close out that win as well while being in a more hostile environment. So I do agree with you there that that's been some positive momentum for them for sure.
Sticking with that zone, I mean, it seems like the Pacers have struggled with zone quite a bit, you know, for years, really, not just this season, but for the past couple of years, it feels like their zones have not been, they haven't broken zones very well. What have you noticed from this team with their ability to break the zone? I remember the in-season tournament when Nimhard and Bruce Brown did a really good job breaking down that zone against the Bucks, but I'm trying to think of other instances where the Pacers have really had those games where they've been able to break zones. And do you think that zone defense is something that could be problematic for the Pacers?
I think some of it here lately, and I know the Pacers themselves have referenced it, is just that they were missing shots as a team. They weren't shooting the ball particularly well, and a lot of that goes back to some of what Tyrese's recent struggles had been. Nembhard had been at like 5 of 20 of his last threes. He made a few shots here recently, so some of it's that. They mainly have two go-to zone busters that they run. One of them's baseline, where they run somebody particularly against a 3-2. They'll set a ball screen and a flare screen that creates a two-on-one advantage over in the weak side corner. Somebody running there, that's usually fairly effective for them. And then the other one that I'm sure most people recognize is Rick Carlisle's on the sideline. He'll hold up an X, and it's typically they go and cross paths and screen the inside of a 2-3, literally making an X, and that creates a hole for Tyrese or TJ to drive through. Something that I've noticed that they've kind of gone away from, and that's where I talk about the attention to detail, is they're not always super quick getting to who the two people are that are going to go set those screens. And then once they do, the point of that is that when Tyrese drives through that hole, it's forcing the opposing team's big to have to step up to meet him or have to step up to meet TJ, because they both are capable of hitting that pull-up too. When they step up there, then the other big for the Pacers who's at the block needs to slide to the corner where their corner shooter is, so that the person at the bottom of the 2-3 zone then has to make a choice. Am I going to cover this big, or am I going to step out to the corner three-point shooter? And most typically they're going to slide with the big and stay there, and that opens up a corner three. But I've noticed a few times where the big has kind of stayed opposite kind of in like the dunker spot instead of actually making that motion and making that defender have to make a choice. So sometimes it kind of goes back to what we were seeing defensively there for a stretch with like the loss to the Spurs and stuff, where really, you know, it's not particularly sexy analysis, but it really can boil down sometimes to just there needs to be more urgency. There needs to be better defensive disposition. With regards to some of their zone stuff, I think that their zone busters typically work and you can understand where the advantages are. It's just about executing them with more precision. That being said, I think that sometimes when you are a good three-point shooting team, which the Pacers had been for most of the season, there can be an advantage for teams in that you're making threes against our man defense. You're going to get different types of threes against our zone, and maybe it's a little bit choppier types of offense that's dependent more on ball movement, rapid ball movement to kind of shake the snow in a snow globe against the zone versus getting as much out of off-ball screening actions and pick-and-roll actions as like what the Pacers are used to. So it can just kind of change what types of shots you're getting. But I think it shouldn't be necessarily a big problem for them in the playoffs if they're just better at executing what they have out there. And then, like I said, like there were times down there in the Pelicans game, because that was another one where zone bothered them, where they put Herb Jones and Trey Murphy at the top of it, kind of hid CJ McCollum in the bottom of it. And like Jarris was on the floor, Nembhard was on the floor, Pascal was on the floor, and none of the three of them were the people in the middle of the zone. It was Jalen Smith. And that was just a little bit like, you know, I don't know if I really want Jalen trying to flash to take a pull-up two in that situation, or be, you know, reading the numbers advantages and getting the ball to the next player when you have those other three options.
Yeah, Kalen, I'm not going to lie. I'm trying to forget every bit of that Pelicans game, obviously. Just a terrible game, obviously. Not a fun one. Tyrese Haliburton minus 40 in that one. But regardless, like, it just – they had a little bit of a slip-up there, a few games where they were really just struggling. And one of the games that I felt like that attention to detail was just not the greatest was against the Cavaliers. And that was a team that was pretty much without three or four of their top guys. And the Pacers had a 17-point lead in the second quarter, and they lose that game by five at home. And it was a pretty pivotal game, too, knowing where they were in the standings. And it just kind of felt like, what's kind of happening here? But I feel like this road trip, now they're 3-1 on the road trip, has kind of been what they needed to get back on track. So we talk about this, and I know it's a little bit cliche, but road trips really can impact a season quite a bit if things go well. And so, you know, we've talked about it a little bit, but just curious, you know, what have you seen different from this team just a week ago with how they closed out that game against Cleveland to the last maybe four games they played on this road trip?
I mean, I think it goes back to some of what we said, right? I mean, it certainly makes a difference when Tyrese starts out that hot and actually forces a change in the types of coverage, and then they're willing to lean into, like I said, Pascal being that counterweight and that chess piece. The team as a whole shooting the ball better certainly makes a difference. But when you're at the end of that Cavs game and it's Tyrese having to rely a lot, I mean, I think over the last 5 minutes of that game, they went 3-10 from the field, 0-7 from three, 0-3 from three over the last 2 minutes. It was a lot of Tyrese trying to get to a step back, and to his credit, something that I had been tracking for a while during, you know, what I guess we'll call it a rough patch, was that he was taking about half of his step back threes to his left, which was atypical for him because as a shooter, it's somewhat quirky because right-handed shooters typically do step back to their left, but Tyrese will more often evade closeouts to his right. But that requires powering off that left leg, which is where the hamstring injury had been. To his credit, against the Cavs, when he had George Niang out there, when he had Jared Allen out there, he was getting to his right. I don't think he was creating quite as much separation as what you would have seen back in November. But when you're not creating quite as much separation, and then you're also not necessarily running some of the blur actions, doing other things to get to a next action to help Tyrese get downhill, the offense got a little bit stagnant, where I don't think it was necessarily what we've come to know of, you know, quote-unquote Pacers basketball. I think that they got back to that a little bit more on the Lakers game and the Clippers game in both cases, and just finding more what we went through, finding where those specific advantages were. And then as a team as a whole, like if we even go back to the rough patch there against, you know, the Pelicans, against the Spurs, the defense has shown some improvement for a couple different reasons as well, where I think Jenny Busick had a comment where like, yes, we're not making shots right now, but we're showing that we can find other ways to win, where they did win some games despite the fact, you know, against Orlando, they shot below 35% from three, a couple other games where they shot below 35% from three, and they were still able to come out ahead. So then when the ball did start falling again, maybe you can rely on some of those principles, although that didn't necessarily pan out in the game against the Lakers when you're giving up 150 points. But they have shown, I feel, in my opinion, some strides on the defensive end of the floor that aren't just completely tied to injury luck from opponents or just shooting luck from opponents too.
Yeah, I mean, how much do you look into defensive rating when you're looking at that as a statistic? Because therefore, I think before the Lakers game, the previous eight games, I think they were like top four in defense. So it was pretty interesting to see that they had improved that much. But is that a metric that you really think tells the whole story?
I mean, I always try to look at it game by game, and I'm always going to watch the process more than the results. In terms of, sometimes you can defend a possession really well and an opponent might still make a tough shot. In other cases, you might not have defended it very well at all and they might miss an open shot. There is that type of variance. So I look at it and it certainly matters. Like, you definitely don't want to be giving up 150 compared to what they've been doing in some of those other prior games, but I can look at very clear strategic things that they had done differently in some of those games. Like, it's not going to come off as obvious, I'm sure, to a lot of people, but I really do give Tyrese quite a bit of credit, because I know Rick Carlisle's mentioned it. He's been a lot more physical as a defender. It's not even just that. They're using him a lot more to step out and do a quick show and prevent giving up mismatches to Paolo Guancaro, not giving up as many mismatches to Shai Gilgeous, not giving up as many mismatches with him to LeBron or whoever, Kawhi Leonard, whoever it is. And he's not just stepping out there and like waving a hand and then running back to his original assignment. So if you don't have to double battle Guancaro in the post, then you're not putting the defense into rotation as much as what the Pacers were having to do earlier in the year. So that is one little thing. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say that Tyrese is necessarily in and of himself been a plus defender, but I do think he's made strides on the end of that end of the floor, and I do think that's a pretty major credit to him given what he was working through on the other side of the ball, that he was still committing himself to making that change in those types of coverages and showing on a lot more of those picks.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this episode of Setting the Pace. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement Systems, or simpler, EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Whether you're here in Indiana or hundreds of other locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/pace to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/pace, P-A-C-E. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System. Now, let's get back to the show. Yeah, I will say, like, just from probably someone that doesn't catch things as much as you do, you can just, if you watch Tyrese on defense at all, there's still games where I think he's not as physical. Right. But especially in that OKC game, like, that to me was one that really just stood off the page, like how physical he was in that game, trying to get out there and kind of, you know, I thought he was pretty good defensively. Like, for what you're asking him to do, I thought, man, is he taking that big of a stride defensively? Like, that's one thing that he really has got to get better on. He's going to be hunted in the playoffs. Everybody knows that. So How is he going to be able to fix that? And I think you bring up a great point of how they're working on trying to find different ways to mask what he, you know, what that weakness is on defense. But I think Tyrese, like, it's been a learning curve for him, obviously, like the whole injury coming back from it, the inefficient shooting nights, like just a terrible couple of weeks there where he was just really struggling. But you're starting to see him find different ways to impact the game. And I think Rick Carlisle talked about that after the Clippers game. Like, we got to quit talking about Ty shooting every night because there's other ways he can impact the game. But I do think that while we probably shouldn't talk about it every night, the shooting is very important still because it opens up so much still. But I feel like just Tyrese is slowly starting to get back to who he once was. But I'm not really sure. Where do you think he is at right now based on before the injury and now that he's back from the injury?
I mean, I still don't fully think that he's completely 100%. I mean, I think they even referenced that themselves, that he's continuing to make progress. He's better than what he was 2 weeks ago. I think you could very much tell in that game against the Spurs that something's going on here when he goes from averaging 53 ball screens per 100 possessions to he's in that game and it's 29. Like, that's a drastic drop. And yes, like, there is a difference in running actions. You're not going to run as many actions directly at Wemby because he is very spooky in the lane. That's a thing. And it also mattered that they were going through a time of not only just trading Buddy Hield, but also Doug McDermott's dealing with a calf injury. Ben Shepherd has bronchitis. The types of movement shooters that allow them to get into stack into some of, like, the ghost screening stuff that Tyrese has really thrived on this year, they didn't have people to run that stuff with. So instead, Tyrese was having to do that. Like, it's Tyrese as the cutter under the basket, running around pin downs and doing other things. It changed his role to a degree, but also I think you could just tell that not only was he being moved around the different parts of the actions, he didn't look like he was moving quite the same within the actions. Like I said, it wasn't normal for him to be stepping back to his left that often. So what's causing him to do that? And that's where some of the movement shooter stuff does show up more, because if you're not creating the same degree of separation for yourself, then he needs some assistance in having somebody else create some of it with, you know, a little bit of a hesitation with a ghost screen or whatever it may be. Last night, and I think in the Golden State game, probably more than anything, that was him looking more like, I'm taking some of the outlandish, you know, audacious Tyrese type of shots. He did take one to his right, although he didn't necessarily have to create as much separation because it was against Chris Paul. He took so much deeper shots. The Clippers one's a little bit like, you know, we'll keep watching. Definitely good. Ball goes in hoop, always a good thing. But, like, it's coming with him having a lot of breathing space with Zubac dropped, like, 2 feet into the paint. And then after halftime, when the Clippers were doing more of their switching defense, and granted, a lot more of the offense shifted towards those shots being filtered towards Siakam and Miles for reasons that we already talked about, I think he went like 2 of 6 after Zubac came out of the game, not just from three, but like overall. So I think that some of this is like, sometimes players just don't make shots. They're human beings. Like, that's an element of it too. And I just think it's pretty clear that Tyrese is still working through some things. And I think that that's, you know, okay. And just something that he's going to have to continue to manage.
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on there about that drop coverage. Like, he had so much space with Zubac not really even getting out there. I mean, Terrence Mann was fighting for his life over that screen to just even put a hand up. And I give him credit for, you know, following what the game plan was. But, like, that's just really hard to do, especially when Tyrese has that much space to get a shot off. And we know what a prolific scorer he can be and shooter he can be. So there was a moment there, though, in the I think it was the second quarter when Tyrese got hit by Kawhi Leonard and kind of went down and was grabbing. And it just kind of felt like, oh, God, is this about to happen to the Pacers? Like, you know, we're getting this close to the end of the season. He's starting to make his way back, and all of a sudden you see this. And he looked like he was kind of shaken up a little bit. And I know Quinn Buckner mentioned it, like, on defense, it looked like he tried a little bit harder that next possession almost to kind of test out that hamstring and see how it felt. But, I mean, did your heart skip a beat a little bit when you saw that happen?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, you definitely feel for him because it has been good, like, regardless of what the types of coverage is. Like, it was a point that I had made when I was doing my mailbag here last week and being like, you know, a lot of teams are still sending two on the ball toward him, and I'm surprised they're not testing that out. Like, in games when he's gone 1 of 9, like, why are you still sending two to Tyrese when Miles is kind of thrashing you in the short roll and in the free throw line area? But that's what opponents were doing. To the Clippers' credit, maybe they were considering, like, hey, he didn't actually look for his own shot that much last night against the Lakers. Maybe we can play more conservatively and drop, and maybe he'll be looking to move the ball elsewhere. Once he proved them wrong and was like, you know, I came here to play today, I'm hunting my shot pretty aggressively, they eventually did make an adjustment. But yeah, when I saw him tweak that, for sure, like, you just definitely feel for him because, like I said, all of this has started to go back in his favor. He's starting to look more like the Tyrese that we've come to know, as I said, taking, you know, some of the audacious shots. The vibe seemed to be back, especially in that win over Golden State, just for the team as a whole. So You don't want to see him dealing with anything, but it sounds like, I didn't see any additional reporting that he was necessarily limited by that, and he kept playing. So that's good.
Yeah, big sigh of relief that he was able to finish that game out, because, I mean, the last thing you need is for another injury to happen to him. I mean, you just feel so bad for the guy because he's dealt with two injuries around the same time. And, you know, this is an opportunity for him to really get a taste of the playoffs. I mean, I don't really know if people have a ceiling for what the Pacers can do come the postseason, but I just think that you want to see them as fully healthy as they possibly can be without, you know, without Mathurin obviously being out for the rest of the season. But, like, everybody else, like, it seems like this team's playing pretty good basketball right now. They have pretty good synergy, so you kind of want to see what that can become. But I do want to spend some time here kind of closing out our first, you know, episode here today, as we're doing a part one, part two, talking about Jairus Walker, because Jairus Walker was so good in that game against the Clippers, and he's been in and out of the rotation, got a little bit of an opportunity when the Mathurin news broke, but still didn't really find himself a solidified spot with the second unit, and he was pretty iffy. You know, I think there were some games he did not look great when he did get some minutes out there, and he, I know Rick gave him a little bit more as he continued to play well, but this was obviously his best game probably of the season, getting a career high in assists with 7 assists and then a plus 23 for the game as well. Just, like, really did a good job and got the nod to be with the starting five with no Nesmith last night to start the second half. So what were your thoughts on Jairus last night, and how much have you seen him improve from maybe just a couple of weeks ago to now?
That's definitely a feel-good moment, right? Like, I don't want to speak for him or assume how he's felt, but I'm guessing that when he got drafted to the Pacers and saw at the time the massive hole that they had at the 4 spot, he probably expected his rookie season to be a lot different than what it has been to this point. And I think some of his games have still been up and down, like you referenced. I thought he played really well against the Bulls. I thought he earned and deserved some of the minutes that he was getting in overtime. The fact that he played over 20 minutes in that game, I thought, was entirely warranted. Then they played the Nets, and his initial first stint in the first half was kind of rocky again, with some defensive mistakes and miscues and some of his decision-making on drives around to the basket, where he was a little bit floater reliant again, and then he kind of fell out of the rotation after that point. But, you know, they needed him last night, and he stepped up and answered what they did. Like, how much of a bigger call is it that you're, after Ben Shepherd had kind of just been, Paul George had just been kind of shooting over the top of Ben Shepherd, for him to get thrown out into that starting lineup in the second half? And in the first half, he was mainly guarding Norman Powell and kind of being a corner defender, which is kind of how I've envisioned him. They were putting him on Paul George in some of those possessions, and I won't tell everybody that the defense was perfect, but I think that, like, you could see the vision of both the tools and the instincts for him on that end of the floor in this game, probably more than any other, because there were times where he was giving up quite a bit of separation to Paul George or to Kawhi Leonard, and it didn't matter because his wingspan is what it is, that he was still able to close and provide some sort of a contest on some of those shots. And then also just, he was making the right rotations on time, and even there was one where he rotated quickly to PJ Tucker slipping out of a screen, then Russell Westbrook made a cut and he rotated to Russell Westbrook. He picked up a foul in that possession. I was like, I don't even care, because you didn't overshoot. You didn't try to shoot into the passing lane. You were just where you needed to be. Likewise, there was a few times, I think I wrote in my piece this morning, I referred to him as him. He was shining in the shadows. Like, it wasn't just that he was making the touch passes or like the fake shot pass, or that he made a three off of movement and his shooting stroke looked really smooth, or that he used that really great windmill move, the swim move, to get around to be able to make the pass to Pascal Siakam. Like, there was a lot of flashbulb moments for him, but there was also a lot of little quiet moments where it was like, you know, 2 weeks ago when they played the Toronto Raptors, he was stunting incredibly hard at Kelly Olynyk for no apparent reason, and Grady Dick was cutting behind him. And today he's stunting at Paul George, but still staying with arm's reach of this ball side corner and really being a lot more principled with what he was doing. So he made a case for himself, quite honestly. Like, what he did in that game was important. They needed it. And I think that there is a case for, like, in certain matchups, certain games, where maybe you do lean on him a little bit more on than Doug McDermott. Maybe if Doug's having a really great shooting game in the first half and you don't need Jarris to the degree that you did last night against a very wing-heavy roster, you make different choices. But I think that he made a compelling case for himself, and I agree with you. I think that was his best game of the season.
I'm glad you brought up Doug McDermott, because that was going to be a segue into my next conversation, because, like, Doug obviously was out for a while with that. Was it a calf strain, I believe it was? And he's back, looks a lot better. I mean, he played a lot better against the Lakers and shot the ball particularly well in that game. Didn't look too great against the Clippers. I don't think that's a great matchup for him, and I think everything is kind of matchup dependent. But if you were to pick between those two, if you're looking at like a playoff rotation type thing, do you trust either of them, or do you just go to more of an eight-man rotation?
I mean, playoffs rotations tend to shorten, right? I think that's somewhat the cliche. It's going to be interesting to watch for the Pacers, though, because all year long, they've really overwhelmed with their pace. And I think part of the reason why they're able to maintain that pace is because Rick's been willing to go deeper and play an all-bench unit. They've played a 10-man rotation in a lot of games. Will they be willing to do that in the playoffs so that they can continue to maintain that? I think that that's something that's going to be really interesting to watch. I mean, we all know, we've seen Doug in the playoffs for the Pacers, right? And the series against Boston and the series against Miami, he got played off the floor in Boston because that was against a switching defense. That takes away a lot of what he's able to do as somebody who's at his best, I think, as a shooter when he's coming off of screens. If you switch those off-ball screening actions, there's not a lot he's going to do against that at that point. And then if you need to switch defensively, he can become a weaker link there, although they're doing a little bit more show coverage with him, just like they're doing with Tyrese when you watch some of these games. And then in the series with Miami, it was somewhat similar, like no Sabonis in that. In the bubble series, I think Doug was 2 of 10 for the entire series. Like, he just wasn't getting shots. Yeah. So that's all in the back of my mind when I look forward to, you know, how would he be used? But obviously the offense is quite different under Rick Carlisle. And a part of that is like what I said, it wasn't just that, like, it's not only what the chemistry was between Tyrese and Buddy, it was the fact that that was occurring at the same time as they didn't have the other movement shooters. When Doug's out there, like, he ended up being in the closing lineup there at the end of the game with the other four main starters, in part because it allows Tyrese to get back to running some of those pet plays. Now Doug can be a stack screener. Now Doug can go screen for Tyrese to an extent so that you can at least have a feasible means of doing that. So I can go back and forth. I think that expecting Jarris to hop in and do that when he hasn't played a lot of regular minutes might be asking a bit much, but it's always good to have that type of flexibility. And like I said, he provided reason to really consider it and for us to be talking about it right now, which I don't think we probably would have been doing like 2 weeks ago, or especially, you know, when he was more heavily being played in the G League, which I just want to admit and say that, like, for everybody who was like, not me calling you out, but for everybody that like didn't really like that he was getting those G League minutes, maybe he's not in this place to have that game against the Clippers if he wasn't there getting those reps and being ready and getting better prepared to do it. So,
and I think some people are just kind of, and I hate to say it like this, but it's just the truth. I think they're ignorant in terms of what the G League is doing for a guy like Jarris. It's not that he's being demoted to go down there and say, okay, get some minutes down here because we can't find minutes for you here. It's, no, you have some things you need to work on, and this is the perfect place for you to do it. Like, it is like a developmental system kind of like minor league baseball. Like, that's kind of how you have to look at it. It's like, we want you to be a pivotal piece of the professional team, but you're just not there yet. And we did invest a lot of money in you with a high pick, but we're trying to win. And so it's that weird balance of trying to win and also develop. And that is what the G League's for. And I feel like the Mad Ants have done a really good job of being able to incorporate him into their team and not kind of mess up their flow too, because they've made the playoffs this year again, and they look like a team that's really figured things out in the G League team. So, you know, that to me is just a bit of a bummer when you're trying to explain to people, like, why is he on assignment for this game? It's not a demotion. To me, I want people to make sure they understand, like you said, this is where he's getting better. And Carlisle has talked about that before in some pregame, postgame stuff, you know, like the willy-nilly gambles, that kind of thing. But there's other things that he has to work on, and the feel of the game is something he naturally has, but the speed of the game is different. And I think it's still fast for him, but I think it's game 73 against the Clippers, right? So he's starting to kind of figure things out a little bit more and what it takes to keep yourself on the court in an NBA game.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, like, just overall, like, I agree with all of that. And I think that the Pacers coaching staff has been in communication. I think Tom Hankins is good at his job as well, giving very specific directives on things that they want to see Jarris be working on in order for him to be able to step in and take advantage of some of those opportunities that have been there with people in and out of the lineup. And especially, like, that's the thing, like, they missed Aaron Nesmith, like, definitely in that Laker game when Aaron got into foul trouble, you could see it right away. Because as much as I just talked about and kind of praised Tyrese for doing more show coverage, as soon as Aaron picked up that third foul in the second quarter, it was like right away, like, LeBron's like, okay, Austin Reeves, come screen for me, because now we're going to get Pascal and Tyrese into the same action and we're going to cook. And so when you're going into this game with that many wings out on the floor, I was wondering, like, how much is Aaron Nesmith's absence going to be felt given what we just saw in that game last night whenever he was in and out of the lineup and Jarris helped bridge some of that gap. So I give him a lot of credit, and I just think it was a really cool and good moment for him, especially this late in the season.
You think it would have been too much to ask Jarris to do that against the Lakers?
Potentially, because I will say this, if you go back and watch both of those games, and I don't mean this to be super harsh or derogatory, the Clippers, in a lot of respects, looked very old and slow in that game. And the overall, some of what I was pointing out about the Pacers and games against the Pelicans and the Spurs, some of that was very real for the Clippers in that game. Like, that doesn't change anything for the Pacers. The Pacers hit the right buttons that they needed to hit. The right adjustments were made. I think the right lineup combinations were out on the floor when they needed them to be out there. And for the most part, pretty much everybody on the roster played well. But the Clippers were not putting their best product out there. And it was a very stark contrast into where both teams are currently at right now. So I think that's a little bit harder to compare.
Yeah, I think that's fair too. I was just curious because we really didn't see Jarris in that game against the Lakers. And, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie was having his way at points. Austin Reeves having his way. Like, when Anthony Davis and LeBron get their numbers, like, you expect that. But when the third and the fourth punch do the same thing, like, it's just hard to overcome. Despite the officials, like, I understand, like, the officiating was not great, but there's other ways the Pacers could have been more impactful in that game. But I mean, the officiating was not great. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, it's not something I want to keep harping on, but I mean, did you feel like the officiating really took them out of the game?
I refuse to be a ref analyst because I feel like auditing every missed call and non-call is as miserable as what it was for all of us to watch the Lakers shoot 43 free throws at 12 o'clock in the morning. I will say that I think it flew a little bit under the radar that Anthony Davis picked up his third foul with over 5 minutes to play in the second quarter, and the Lakers gambled and left him on the floor for the next 4 minutes and 29 seconds. The Pacers proceeded to go 4 of 11 from the field, and the only person who attempted or even tried to get into Anthony Davis's body during that next 4.5 minutes was Siakam. He drove at him twice, and very notably both times, Anthony Davis just backed out of the way. Like, you could tell he was like, I'm not going to risk getting my fourth foul in this first half. So to me, it would have been one of two things. Either he does pick up the fourth foul, or it just becomes easier offense for you because he doesn't want to pick up the fourth foul, which made it easy for Pascal to score pretty easily in those types of actions. And yet the Pacers, almost every shot they took, if you look at their next however many shots they just set, almost everything was threes or from mid-range other than what Pascal did. So I felt like that was a pretty big missed opportunity for them. That you can't guard Anthony Davis. You've shown that in two games now. He had 36 and 16. And some of it for the Pacers, that's why it was very different than what the Clippers were doing, because the Pacers were getting put into rotation a lot because they were having to send doubles at AD. And where they've been better at kind of defending on a string, that wasn't really showing up, particularly in the third quarter. Ben Shepherd kind of uncharacteristically made a couple mistakes rotating out of those double teams. Pascal eventually just looked like he was exhausted. There was one that he missed late in the fourth quarter that was pretty egregious, and it was like he just couldn't get there. Like, he just looked like all of his energy had been drained from everything he had done in the third quarter. But, like, I think that you probably needed to be a little bit more proactive to force the issue, because the Pacers weren't the only people that had people in foul trouble. Like, I don't think that it really got pointed out that much that Anthony Davis had picked up that many fouls that early.
Yeah, I think it was just kind of like the whole, like, the Pacers got called for a delay of game, and then LeBron and Anthony Davis can, you know, went over there and talked with Mark Davis for like a good 25, 30 seconds, it felt like, before he finally gave the ball to Miles Turner to shoot the free throw. So, you know,
that alone was very frustrating. I don't understand why we're taking time out and icing Miles at the free throw line. That I will say, confused me quite a bit.
That was what I was more annoyed with. It was like, how is that not a delay of game, when what they call a delay of game on the Pacers for? Was it because there was somebody on the court or something? I couldn't remember what they called that for, yeah. But it was like immediately after that play ended, they called a delay of game on the Pacers. And I thought, what did they do? I didn't really catch it. And then that whole situation took place after. And then at that point, I was just like annoyed at that point, because I try to do this as an analyst for the most part and not get too biased with my fandom, but I think LeBron James and just the torture that he's caused me as a Pacers fan before I started doing the podcast, it's just sitting there. And it was kind of crazy, just 31-6 in terms of the free throws. But I'm going to move on from it, Caitlin, I promise. I'm just moving back to Jarris as we close things out for this portion of the pod. But just some great stuff post-game about Jarris, which I loved. The way Rick Carlisle said, like, he's the reason they won that game. Pascal Siakam immediately kind of went straight to, like, how proud he was of him and what he did. So, like, just getting that vote of confidence. And I think even Jarris said it, like, man, that feels so good to hear Coach say that. Like, that really means a lot. Like, he really took that to heart, that Coach gave him that praise. So, I mean, to me, this feels like it could be a real confidence booster for him moving forward, as it's been a tough year for him.
I think in part that's like an underrated element of adding Pascal to an extent too, because he's been through this journey. He's played in the G League. He's very self-made. He's a great development story in terms of how he's turned himself into an all NBA player. So to have that same person in the locker room, being able to be in Jarris's ear and be a very clear example of like, hey, yeah, like for Jarris, what I just referenced earlier, like I'm sure his rookie season didn't go the way that he envisioned it on draft night. This has probably been a lot more difficult than what he anticipated it was going to be. So, and I think that Rick too is very, I don't want to say strategic. I think that Jarris did play very well, but I think sometimes he points things out for very specific reasons. And it probably was valuable for Jarris to get that type of positive feedback from everybody involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he needed it. It's been a rough year for him. And I have heard Coach Carlisle say that multiple times. Like, you know, we've just been telling him, just be ready. You never know when that time's going to come. So, everybody, we're going to be back tonight with a post-game recap of the Pacers Bulls, and me and Caitlin are wearing red here today, but we're not supporting the Chicago Bulls here. We are supporting the Indiana Hoosiers, and Caitlin's, I don't know if you're supporting anybody, but just rocking the red today. But we're not supporting the Bulls. I thought it was hilarious when we both popped up on the camera both in red. I said, what are the odds of that? We just beat the Clippers and now we're playing the Bulls and we're both wearing red. Maybe we just had red on our mind. But IU women's basketball got a big win, so they are in the Sweet 16. Congratulations to them. I talked about that yesterday, but since I'm an IU fan, I'm going to throw it out there again. But we'll have a post-game podcast. Bocce will be back, and then me and Caitlin will be back on Friday for part two of this conversation. So we're going to take a break, guys. We'll see y'all later tonight.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.